The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. I'm Sam Livingston and I will be your substitute co-host on today's show. I'll be taking the first half of today's program and then Richard Palmer from England will take the second half. You can watch the show live, watch the video stream live at thetrumpet.com/live. If you have any feedback, you can send that to td@thetrumpet.com. On the first half of today's show, we'll talk about the events of January 6, 2022, what Joe Biden called Remembrance Day in his speech yesterday, and then we'll talk about some more details about the fake insurrection. I believe Mr. Palmer is going to talk to you about a real insurrection going on right now in Central Asia. A few headlines that I saw this morning just before the show, the Biden vaccine mandate, the OSHA mandate, is before the Supreme Court right now, and the liberal justices have had quite a few fact checks that have from sources that, you know, people are just wondering, well, where did they come up with these numbers? Justice Breyer said yesterday there were 750 million new COVID cases in the United States. Now, I'll give him a break. It was 750,000, so he misspoke there. But Sonia Sotomayor said that there are 100,000 children in America's ICU systems right now because of COVID. And everyone is wondering, where did she pull that number from? Right now, it's 3,000 children, and they're in ICUs with COVID, and they could be in there for a host of any other reason. So these are the most educated among us, and they are peddling fake news. Then there was the jobs report that came in for the month of December, another miserable report, 200,000 jobs, once again, far below the low bar that the Biden administration sets for itself. And now on to the sobering memorial from yesterday, Nancy Pelosi. This is a tweet from Bloomberg. They said, Nancy Pelosi held a moment of silence for four law enforcement officers who died because of January 6th. Go ahead and play clip one.
As I conclude, I want to acknowledge our fallen heroes of that day. U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Howard Livingood, Metropolitan Officer Jeffrey Smith, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Billy Evans of a later assault. Now I ask all members to rise for a moment of silence in their memory.
Notice she says that Billy Evans, who died of a later assault, he died weeks after January 6th when a left-wing terrorist drove his car through the barricades surrounding the Capitol and rammed it into two police officers, killing Willie Evans. Nancy Pelosi says that's a January 6th victim somehow. Brian Sicknick died in the days following January 6th, and they have not revealed a cause of death. They say that it was a stroke. Initially, they said it was the fire extinguisher, then it was the bear spray, and neither of those things have panned out. We'll talk about later how the Capitol Police used flashbangs on that crowd, a tactic or a weapon that's known to cause seizures, heart attacks, and strokes. The two other police officers committed suicide weeks after the event. We don't know why they committed suicide, but Nancy Pelosi says, well, it's obviously because of what they experienced on January 6th. So going forward, anyone who has ever been a Capitol Police officer, if it's 30 years down the road and they die from Alzheimer's, that is Alzheimer's induced by January 6th rioting. So every death now going forward is because of these Trump supporters. Matt Walsh says, Sicknick died of a stroke. Evans was killed by a leftist lunatic. The other two were suicides. Pelosi is lying blatantly and shamelessly, but she's in the ruling class, so she is allowed to do this without consequence. This is how they work. They lie, and they just assume you're too dumb to go look into it for yourself. Pelosi also had members from the cast of the Broadway musical Hamilton sing a song over Zoom to memorialize the deaths of these police officers. It was pretty difficult to watch, very awkward. I call it the memorial for millennials. It's just funny to see Pelosi and a lot of these senators who are very old try to appeal to the younger crowd using these things. The New York Times has a good rundown of the day's events. We obviously played the clips from Biden and Harris speaking. At noon, the House convened for a session that included a prayer, speeches, and a moment of silence. Then at 2:30, there was a session where lawmakers got together to recount their experiences during the attack. And then at 5:30 p.m., there was a candlelight vigil near the Capitol with the Baltimore Urban Inspiration Choir performing. They had a candle-lit vigil for January 6th. Democrats, of course, blasted Republicans for not participating in this fake memorial, this sacred event. Now, this is a sacred event for the Democrats. They'll never let go of January 6th. There were, however, three Republicans there yesterday. Liz Cheney, she was there to mourn with the Democrats. And Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz were there to hold press conferences in the Capitol exposing the false flag operation that was January 6th. As it turns out, most of the big name Republicans were actually at a funeral in Georgia. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Georgia's Johnny Isaacson remembered as voice of civility in politics. Hundreds of mourners, Republicans and Democrats alike, packed the pews of Buckhead's Peachtree Road United Methodist Church to celebrate Isaacson's ability to cross the aisle to cut deals and crack one-liners. So Mitch McConnell was there. A lot of big-name Republicans were there. They didn't have time to attend the fake memorial for the officers that didn't actually die on January 6th. And no mention of Ashley Babbitt or Roseanne Boyland or the other people that died that day from heart attacks and strokes. Then there was the media's response to Joe Biden's divisive speech. This is clip two.
And I'll tell you this, if you think that speech was partisan, then you believe the former president's lies. It's only a partisan speech if you think there's somehow a truthful dispute here. If you're pro-democracy and pro-America, it is hard to look at that speech and say, oh, it's politically skewed.
This was a speech for the history book.
This was FDR after Pearl Harbor. This is Lyndon Johnson after Selma. This is George W. Bush after 9/11. This was nothing less than Americanism versus authoritarianism. You know, you have to contextualize moments like this in order to cement history. Think about Lincoln at Gettysburg. There was no certainty after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that we would defeat tyranny. There was no certainty after 9/11 that there wouldn't be another attack. You have to tell America and the world what America stands for. Joe Biden's task today was formidable, but again, I think he delivered.
You are not allowed to dislike that speech. I called it Biden's second most divisive speech after the vaccine mandate, where he said our patience is wearing thin and blamed all of America's problems on the unvaccinated. That speech, and you can listen to yesterday's program from Mr. Stephen Fleury on that, was very divisive, and it was filled with lies. But the communists in the media, like any good communist, you can't disagree with Chairman Joe. If you think that speech was partisan, then you believe the former president's lies. It's hard to keep up with the layers of lying that they do. But you can't argue with that speech, because if you argue with that speech, as Chuck Todd says, you are arguing with the truth. And the truth is not debatable. If you are pro-democracy and pro-America, it is hard to look at that speech and say, oh, it's politically skewed. And then, obviously, the point about how bad January 6th must be, that they have to keep reminding us every single day about how horrible it was. We all remember 9/11. I was pretty young. We've seen the pictures from Pearl Harbor. We've read about Gettysburg. It doesn't take daily reminders that those were horrific events. But here with January 6th, they have to decode that for us. They have to remind us because we're apparently too dumb to really comprehend what happened on that day. And if you doubt them, if you question them, well, you must be a Trump-supporting terrorist. He said it was like Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor, like George Bush after 9/11, like Lincoln after Gettysburg. And here they are having to make up deaths for January 6th, picking police officers who died in totally separate incidents weeks after the attack. They're that desperate to milk this day for all that they can. And they think we're all just dumb and we're not going to look into it. You've been working to gather a lot of footage from January 6th. It's difficult. Most of it comes from people recording it on their cell phones. And the people that recording it on their cell phones, they're not the worst ones. They're not involved in the attack. They're not at the front line. It's hard to tell what was going on that day because Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats control the Capitol, will not release that security footage. There are dozens of cameras that would show us every angle, and it's all time-stamped. How did this crowd arrive at the Capitol? How many police were there? What was that interaction like right when it started? Federal prosecutors, they won't let anyone see it. They just cherry-pick the worst of the worst. They give you 30 seconds, and you just take their word for it. They are prosecuting people based on that footage, but the people they're prosecuting aren't allowed to see it. They're not allowed to see the evidence the government is using against them. And by the way, if we want to talk about insurrection, if we want to talk about remembering attacks on the nation's capital, let's look back to May of 2020. You can go ahead and start playing B-roll clip B. Does anybody remember this attempted coup when left-wing insurrectionists broke down fences in front of the White House, just 100 feet from the White House, the seat of the executive branch that rules over the United States? They doused American flags with lighter fluid. They fought against the police. They threw bricks at the police. They pushed back on the police line. They scaled fences trying to get into the White House. At one point, it was so bad, the Secret Service took the president down into the White House bunker. They lit buildings in Lafayette Park on fire. Then on June 1st, you'll remember this because this is the part the media wants you to remember. The police were getting ready to install more fencing to secure the Capitol, and they needed to clear these protesters out. So they warned the protesters, leave the area. They warned them again, leave the area. They warned them a third time, and they wouldn't leave, so they started pushing them back. And they used pepper spray, and they used riot shields to push them out of the way so they could protect the President of the United States. And all we heard about in the weeks following was how President Trump strong-armed the protesters so he could go have a photo op, and they used tear gas, and it wasn't proper crowd control methods. They shouldn't have been so mean to those protesters, those rioters. Where are the memorial for the 150 officers and those battles that were wounded? They set buildings on fire, like I said. They're the aerial shots of smoke rising in front of the White House and Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, on fire. I haven't seen any footage of fire yet on January 6th. There was violence. Those people should be held accountable. But was in that video clip we played, They are attacking the Treasury building, breaking the windows down, vandalizing it, spraying graffiti all over. Then you bounce forward to January 6th, and there was violence. There weren't any fires. But if you want to talk about crowd control, what was going on January 6th? You can go ahead and start playing clip C. And this is the police confronting these protesters. You'll see in this clip, they're rushing, or they're just standing in front of these stairs, and an officer is firing pepper balls into the crowd. And at that point, it doesn't look like it's very violent. Were they provoking the crowd? They pointed paintball guns at the crowd. They threw flashbangs into a very densely packed crowd, something that's highly controversial. Those are grenades, essentially. They call them non-lethal grenades that detonate with a loud boom and a flash and are intended to cause temporary blindness and deafness. But if they go off right next to you, they can burn your face. They can cause permanent deafness. And they started using those at a point where that crowd did not seem very violent. You can hear that one protester explaining how one of those went off right next to his face, and his face is all red, and he can't hear in his ear, and he's blind. Where's the follow-up on what happened to those protesters? Kimberly Strassel writes about this at the Wall Street Journal. She says, well, how come the January 6th committee is not examining the failures of Capitol Police on that day? How are they so underprepared? And then the few that were there were very aggressive. Why would you confront a crowd that large with these aggressive tactics when you're not ready to hold them off? Strassel says, by the evidence to date, Ms. Pelosi's committee sadly isn't going to be the one to provide any of the fact-by-fact analysis of what happened that day. And why is that? Well, it's just like the Mueller investigation. That committee exists to cover something up. Tucker Carlson talked about this Newsweek story, published exclusively by Newsweek, about the FBI leading a group of secret commandos that had shoot-to-kill orders that were part of that crowd. There were snipers around on that day. Evidently, the FBI saw something, and it was probably the fact that there was this anonymous pipe bomber the night before, who we still don't know anything about. Then there was the hippie bus that was supposed to be filled with explosives. We don't know anything about that. And in the days before, this started on January 2nd, January 3rd, the FBI is coordinating with the military on how to be prepared for what's happening on January 6th. And somehow Capitol Police, DC Metro Police, they're just left in the dark about this. They don't know anything about it. And the federal government is ramping up for war. So the FBI was preparing, and they just felt the need to retain that information, to not say anything about it. Newsweek concludes their article, what was it that the Justice Department saw that provoked it to see January 6th as an extraordinary event, something that the other agencies evidently missed or were not told about? And then you look at how Trump supporters that day have been treated. Now, this is just a massive task to undertake. Hundreds of people have been arrested, and some are treated very differently than others for committing the same crime. And some aren't arrested at all for committing worse crimes. Merrick Garland said the FBI does not prosecute people based on politics. So when they say that, that means that's exactly what they're doing. Now, I've gone through and tried to collect some examples to illustrate this point. One man that was arrested, his name is James Douglas Rahm. He's being charged for obstruction of an official proceeding entering and remaining in a restricted building or grounds, disorderly and disruptive conduct in a restricted building, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building, parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building. Rahm walked through, I think he walked through a window after everyone was in there, took some selfies, and left. Now, they posted some things on Facebook I wouldn't have said, but is that something that deserves an FBI raid? Rahm was not violent. He was not accused of being affiliated with any right-wing groups. And yet, this is how the FBI felt they needed to arrest James Douglas Rahm. Play clip four.
People on Penrose Avenue in Atlantic City woke up to a surprising scene. Federal agents on their block raiding a home. Some investigators with Joint Terrorism Task Force written on their jackets. Following the raid, the FBI announcing the arrest of James Douglas Rahm on charges related to criminal acts at the Capitol that day. Wife. Agents focused some of their attention on a garage and carried numerous items out of the home, including computer equipment, boxes, even what appeared to be a crowbar.
What are they collecting evidence for? They don't even say in the indictment that he was affiliated with any group. They took a crowbar from his house. That could be any of us. What are they trying to show? They're trying to embarrass him. They're trying to ruin his reputation. They're trying to ruin his life. Bradley Weeks, charged for the same crimes as Douglas Rahm. Again, said some things on Facebook I wouldn't say. He walked through an open door. Play clip five.
The FBI has arrested a Baker County man for his role in the siege on the Capitol building 2 weeks ago.
Well, we're told it was this morning when they arrested him at the Waffle House you see behind me. In the criminal complaint from the FBI, it says Bradley Weeks entered violently and committed disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. It was ultimately a multiple tips and a video he posted himself on Facebook that led to his arrest.
Now you can read his indictment online. I read it. It's 10 pages long. Again, said some things I wouldn't say, but there wasn't any violence in there. The charge, they say, what they say in that news report is wrong. What he's being charged for are nonviolent crimes. He was such a threat that they had to go and arrest him at breakfast at Waffle House. They couldn't just call. They're trying to embarrass these people. They're trying to humiliate them and ruin their lives. Glenn Allen Brooks, again, charged for trespassing. He entered through a broken window after hundreds of other people had. He was arrested after someone in his prayer group stalked him for a few days to confirm that it was him. And in that indictment, it's laughable. They have pictures of him taking selfies of himself and then walking out the door. This is how he was treated. Clip six.
Federal agents with weapons drawn swoop into Huntington Beach to bust a local man for his alleged role in the January 6th insurrection.
A tip turned in the 61-year-old business owner. Now he's facing federal charges.
Security camera video shows the moment an FBI raid swiftly played out in this Huntington Beach neighborhood Thursday morning. It was just before 6 a.m. when a team of agents with shields, weapons drawn, descended on the home of Glenn Allen Brooks, a neighbor who did not want to be identified, told us it's still stunning to watch.
It was actually kind of scary. I thought it was fake.
According to the criminal complaint, a member of Brooks' prayer group first tipped off federal agents back in January when, in a group chat, the Orange County man shared a selfie standing in the crowd that had broken into the U.S. Capitol. Court documents show various pictures of Brooks appearing to climb through a broken window and then at various spots inside taking photos with his cell phone.
Call him because they can fight. They can figure out where he lives. Say, hey, we got a picture of you in the Capitol. That was trespassing. We're going to arrest you and we're going to charge you. They don't say anything. They show up at his home at 6 a.m. and arrest him in front of all of his neighbors. Adam Honeycutt is another one. They called him. They had his wife and children leave the house so they could go and arrest him, confiscated his guns. And it's the same deal, the pre-dawn FBI raid, one of the most shocking ones that we've talked about on this show before. 69-year-old Joseph Bolanos. This guy could literally have been anybody. He did not go into the Capitol. He walked around it because he was in D.C. that day attending the rally, the constitutionally protected rally. He's in his late 60s. He takes care of his 94-year-old mother. This is clip 8.
The FBI descends on two Manhattan apartment buildings, combing them for evidence in the new tri-state connection to the Capitol riot. One apartment building in Washington Heights, the other on the Upper West Side. And there, neighbors were shocked to learn that 69-year-old Joseph Bolanos could be facing charges in connection with the invasion of the Capitol.
There were two FBI searches today at apartments linked to one man. The first at this brownstone along West 76th Street. The other in Washington Heights, where the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force was seen along Fort Washington Avenue, taking out bags of possible evidence.
They raided his home, and they raided the home of his 94-year-old mother. He's not accused of being connected to Proud Boys or Oath Keepers, and even if he was, that's not a crime. He didn't go into the Capitol. He didn't even cross the perimeter. He was arrested because his neighbor overheard him talking about being at the Capitol that day. They managed to figure out where he lives, where his mother lives, and they arrested him. He was so scared when they came to his door, he had a stroke. He hasn't been charged with anything. He doesn't appear on the FBI website anywhere. They are trying to scare and intimidate people. That's just 5 examples of the 640 people who have been charged with entering or remaining in a restricted federal building or grounds. That's according to the U.S. Department of Justice. 750 people arrested so far, 640 arrested and are being charged with entering or remaining in a restricted federal building or grounds. How many had to go through the pre-dawn raid? Now, politics aside, do you want to live in a country where that is how the chief law enforcement behaves? Again, like we've said on the show, if they committed a crime, yes, prosecute them. But an FBI raid at 6 in the morning, taking away their computers and their cell phones, ruining these people's lives. Now, the radical left is using January 6th as a pretext to persecute its political opponents and shut down debate about the 2020 election. Now, the Trump administration, they were persecuted by the deep state from day one. Since then, the FBI has been fabricating evidence to justify its persecution of that campaign, and now they are doing it to the American people. That's all I've got time for in this segment. I believe Mr. Palmer is going to cover a similar topic, and I think he'll have more of a conclusion for you. So stick around. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
The Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course is a distance learning program that makes the Bible clear and understandable. The correspondence course enables enrollees to learn what the Bible itself says about subjects that affect you and the world you live in. This fascinating Bible course highlights and proves what the Bible says about morality, war, religion, terrorism, and other current events, focusing on the root causes of this world's many problems facing man, as well as their solutions. The Bible and this course also focuses on the reason mankind was created in the first place, the way to happiness, accomplishment, and fulfillment, as well as the truth behind important doctrinal questions, such as what happens after we die, the nature of God, the resurrection, the millennium, and other critical subjects. Enroll today in the Herbert W. Armstrong Bible Correspondence Course. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host in the second half, Mr. Stephen Flurry. coming to you not quite live, close to live, from Edstone, our campus in Edstone, England. This show goes out Friday evening our time after the coming of the Sabbath here in the UK. So I'm recording this just a few hours in advance, but I believe you're probably watching me as the second segment of today's show. Well, last time I was on the show, we spent a while kind of umming and ahhing about, is Russia going to invade Ukraine? Will they? Won't they? Well, they didn't. But they invaded somewhere else instead. That's kind of, I think, the biggest news from this week, aside from some of the ridiculous news stories that have been coming from the left on January 6th. We got a good look at what a real insurrection looks like in Kazakhstan. And Russian troops have just gone in there yesterday, and it's starting to become a pretty big deal. Now, you may be thinking, well, who cares? It's Kazakhstan. Not really even heard of them before. But Kazakhstan is very important geopolitically. It's huge just geographically. It's the world's largest landlocked country. I think we've got a picture that we can show you here of it overlaid on the United States. It's bigger than Texas and Alaska combined, with room to spare for a few other U.S. states in there. So, you know, it's a big deal. It's the world's largest uranium producer, supplying 40% of the world's demand for uranium. It's also a medium-sized oil producer, produces 1.6 million barrels of oil per day, roughly. Just for comparison, that's, you know, Saudi Arabia is 11 million barrels per day, roughly. So it's the 12th biggest oil producer. That's quite a big hit even for oil markets and this kind of thing. But there's even more geopolitical reasons why it's significant, and even biblical reasons why what is happening in here is very significant. And that's what we'll get to. And Kazakhstan doesn't make the news very often, so it's worth taking a few minutes to understand what is happening here. So on Sunday, we began to get protests and even a revolt breaking out in the northwestern region of Kazakhstan. This came in response to a big price increase in LPG, liquid petroleum gas, which over there is what most people use to run their cars. The government raised the price cap on that quite significantly. It was still cheap fuel, I think, for just about anywhere else. But for the people there, it was a massive hike. Less than a week, this movement has spread all across Kazakhstan cities. The government has reversed the price increases. But once those demonstrations got going, well, their goals became much broader. There was talk about food prices. But then eventually now it's just become all about regime change, changing the government. We'll play clip one. This is some footage of the protests, and this is from ITV News telling us and showing us a bit more about what's going on the ground in Kazakhstan.
The sound of gunfire in the city of Almaty today. But tonight there is near silence from Kazakhstan. The internet has been switched off. Protesters can't tell their stories. These images are among the few to emerge from the main city, and they tell only part of the story. What we saw yesterday gives a sense of the scale of the crisis. Protesters have been on the streets for several days, furious at the rising price of fuel and at what they see as a shoulder-shrugging response to their calls for democracy and equality. A statue of the previous president was pulled down while his successor struggled to contain the crisis.
And don't be fooled when it says previous president. That previous president is basically Kazakhstan's current leader. So what we're looking at is a full-on push in some ways for regime change. That leader is Nursultan Nazarbayev, and he's ruled Kazakhstan since, you know, he ruled it while it was part of the Soviet Union. So he is a long-time dictator there. He's not technically prime minister or president right now, but everyone knows he is the man in charge, and that is why they're pulling down his statues. They've got chants like, old man, go away. And he is huge in Kazakhstan. You saw the protest from the main city there. The capital city is smaller, but they changed the name of the capital city even to name it after Nursultan Nazarbayev. So he's the absolute ruler basically there, or has been, and he's been very close to Russia. You know, Nazarbayev didn't want the Soviet Union to end. I think Kazakhstan was the last country to leave the Soviet Union. He doesn't really even believe his country can make it on its own. So he's always been close to Russia. So you've gotten these protests out against him. Kazakh officials, they say that they have eliminated dozens of rioters. They've arrested 2,000. So there have been deaths on the street there. As you saw on that video, they've pulled the plug on the internet. And then I think it was yesterday, or maybe even the evening before, they turned to Russia to help. Here's more from that ITV news report. This is clip two.
They called on their allies for a solution, and today a Russian-led force arrived. Thousands of what are called peacekeepers are being deployed, but some other countries are suspicious of whether their role will be so passive.
Yeah, I don't know whether these peacekeepers will be particularly peaceful, but Russia is sending in their military now, in theory, to put down the riots, I guess, or to stabilize the situation. But really, this moves Kazakhstan much more into Russia's orbit. You know, they're sending in these paratroopers. You saw some of the military vehicles in that footage there. It's a massive increase in power. They had a lot of power, Russia did, in this country before. Now they've got soldiers in there. But why does Russia care? I mean, we mentioned some important facts at the start about Kazakhstan's resource wealth. But there's more to it than that. Peter Zeihan, he put out an excellent video on the situation for Zeihan on geopolitics for his email brief. And well, here he is with some good maps talking about why Russia is so concerned about what is happening here in Kazakhstan.
You'll notice that all the population density is really further south. And the population density in South Kazakhstan is just the beginning of the story, not the end. The Russian fear is that that big swath of open in Kazakhstan is something that cannot be defended against. And since the Russian population is in terminal demographic decline, but the population growth rates in the Central Asian republics are rising, the Russians see this region as a whole as a security threat in and of itself, and as a potential avenue for Islamic fundamentalism to come up from places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. So in the ideal Russian situation, all of these populations would be locked down so that they cannot cause problems for the Russians. They'd be put into completely tough totalitarian systems that would squash any dissent, shoot anyone who causes any problems. That is kind of the Russian goal here, and preferably to do so with Russian assistance. And in the case of Kazakhstan, the Russians pretty much have that locked up.
So as you saw on that map there, you know, Kazakhstan's northern borders are pretty close to kind of the Russian heartland, or some of the higher areas of Russian population density. When you start to get to the northern borders of Kazakhstan, you're even getting close in the northwest to kind of the Stalingrad area, the Volga River area, but certainly some of those areas that have a higher Russian population density. Then you get into the middle. So you could, from northern Kazakhstan, you can kind of threaten the Russian heartland very effectively. You get to the middle of Kazakhstan and it's just empty. There's no good mountain ranges, massive rivers or anything like that to as a block for anybody coming into those Russian heartlands. So really, Russia wants to push any adversaries all the way, at least to the other side of Kazakhstan, all the way out of that area. It would never happen because Russia would never in a million years let it happen. But if you had Kazakhstan as, say, a NATO member or with a United States military presence in the north of Kazakhstan, you know, they would be directly threatening Russia's key population centers. It would, you know, it would be game over for Russia. It would be absolutely disastrous. You can kind of almost see just on this Google Maps image, if you're on the video, just even you can get a picture of some of the population density just from the city labels. You've got quite a lot of cities on Russia's border around Kazakhstan. You've got some in Kazakhstan's north, and then you get this big empty area in the middle. So Russia needs to control that, or they at least need to be able to push anybody, any potential adversaries out, and they need to make sure that nobody can come across easily across that big, wide, open area that's in the middle of Kazakhstan. You know, that area in the middle of Kazakhstan, it's empty. For 2,000 years, it's been a superhighway for invaders, for nomadic horsemen and all this kind of thing to move around very quickly. So Russia needs to keep enemies out of Kazakhstan. It needs to be able to push people out. And that's part of the reason why it's held a strong presence there. It's a key part of Russia's defense, a very critical part in their defensive armor. And so this is why they're very eager to get involved. They already have a ton of influence in Kazakhstan. Now they have an opportunity to have a whole lot more. We'll watch in just a second one more clip from that Peter Zeihan video. It is a very good video. Actually, we have an article on our website with Kazakhstan in flames, Russia's moving in. That's a great resource if you want to learn more about this. Jeremiah's written up exactly what is going on. So if you want to go over some of this material in your own time, I'd really recommend that. But then I noticed he picked up on this Peter Zeihan video as well. He links to that within his piece. So the video is unlisted on YouTube. That's probably the easiest way to find it if you wanted to watch that and if you want to get more of an understanding of what's going on here for yourself. But here's one more clip from that Peter Zeihan video talking about Russia's involvement here.
The point being is that the Russians have always seen Kazakhstan as tilting towards them. And now that Nursultan Nazarbayev has actually invited the Russians to deploy troops, oh boy, are they. It took less than a day for the first paratroopers to arrive. We now have an undisclosed number of peacekeepers coming from Russia. And the Russians are probably going to get exactly what it is that they've always been after. A forward troop presence in multiple places in Kazakhstan, hard up on the southern borders, and a country that is now under complete political lockdown. So barring significant and honestly very unexpected international action on this situation, Kazakhstan is about to become at best a satellite state like Armenia or Belarus. Its days of being functionally independent or even nominally independent are pretty much over.
So it's a big deal for Kazakhstan, and it changes everything for Central Asia. You know, Russian troops used to be 500 or 600 miles from countries like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. And that gave these countries a measure of independence from Russia, especially Uzbekistan. And that has changed now. Those Russian troops are going to be a whole lot closer. They'll be right on Uzbekistan's borders. They'll be right on Kyrgyzstan's borders. They'll be right on some of these other countries' borders. Now, Zeihan, in that video, he went on to talk about how Uzbekistan rather likes its independence from Russia. And that they may try and push back if they want to try and keep that independence, which could make things interesting. But this really establishes Russia's control over Central Asia in a way that we have not seen since the days of the Soviet Union. The Center for European Policy Analysis, they had an article talking about the Russia's intervention, talking about the Commonwealth of Independent States. This is the group. You know, technically, it's not Russia sending in these soldiers. It's the Commonwealth of Independent States. It's like Russia's equivalent of NATO. Really, it's kind of Russia and allies. But they wrote about it, saying today it is behaving more like the Warsaw Pact, entering a Russia-allied state to prop up a leadership threatened by a popular uprising. So this entire Russian alliance, the Commonwealth of Independent States, is starting to look more like a Warsaw Pact than something like NATO, a tool for Russia to exert control over countries that were once part of the Soviet Union. Now, last time I was with you on this show, we talked about a prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 38. And we were talking about this in context of Ukraine. But this prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 38 contains a critical prophecy about an end time leader. And as we went through then, if you look at the correct translation of Ezekiel 38 verses 1 and 2, it's talking about a prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. That's the way it should be translated. And Meshek was referring to, well, a name that eventually became, you know, Moscow, Russia's capital, Tubal, Tobolsk, in what was historically a very major city in Russia's east. And this Prince of Rosh is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has talked a lot about. We've got a whole booklet on him called the Prophesied Prince of Russia. And, well, he's talked about this on his Key of David program as well. And he's made some very specific forecasts based on what the Bible says about this Prince of Russia. You know, you can read Ezekiel 38 and 39, and he shows this in this book. This Prince of Rosh is a very significant figure in end time events. The Bible has a lot to say about a kings of the East, for example. Revelation 16 talks about that. An Eastern alliance of kings that ultimately ends up confronting Jesus Christ himself. But this is an alliance that shakes the whole world, even perhaps in a literal sense, when you think about nuclear weapons and some of the weaponry that they'll be using. So it's a massive, massive alliance. And this Prince of Rosh is the key figure in this Kings of the East alliance. But, here's just a clip from a Key of David program where Mr. Flurry was talking about this Prince of Rosh and some of what the Bible says about him.
Rosh was the ancient name of Russia, once called Rus, R-U-S. Many encyclopedias and commentaries, such as the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, recognize this. So, who is this Prince of Russia? Moscow and Tobolsk. The use of three names states that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia from the west to the east. This great swath of land, all the way from the east to the west. Now, that's a huge piece of real estate. And here is an individual ruler that rules all of this whole vast area that sounds very much like the former Soviet Union. And already Russia has conquered states that were in that former Soviet Union. Georgia won, and now the Ukraine. They control Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin ordered a devastating cyber attack against Estonia in 2007. So this prophecy, if you think about it, indicates that they may take some more of those nations in that former Soviet Union. And there's a reason why Vladimir Putin is doing that, because he thought that was the greatest time of Russia's glory in this modern age. That's the way he thinks. Now, he's going to be, I think, taking over some more of those countries that were in that area.
So that was Mr. Flurry 5 years ago. 5 years ago, based on this prophecy, saying, well, I think Vladimir Putin is going to take over more countries in the former Soviet Union. That's what has happened this week. These protests provided him with an opportunity. I think we talked last time about how he's been planning for a long time to get more involved in Ukraine, to get more control over Ukraine and all of Eastern Europe, and what's happening there really does seem like it's proceeding according to a very well thought through plan. This time, this looked more like something that just came up that he wasn't anticipating, but he grabbed that opportunity with both hands. And what a massive expansion towards the former Soviet Union that we've seen this week. You know, that forecast, we have seen that powerfully fulfilled just over the last few days. And that's a forecast based right on some of these scriptures, right out of the Bible. And it's been happening before your eyes this week. You know, the largest landlocked country in the world, world's largest producer of uranium, 12th largest oil producer, boom, it's now added basically back into Putin's empire. Now, like I said, it was never super independent from that empire, but much more firmly under Russian control. And then more than that, moving Russian power now much further south, giving them much greater control over all the other stans, all of these other countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union that are down there in Central Asia. You know, this is an incredible extension of territory in terms of rebuilding the former Soviet Union. I mean, purely in terms of, say, miles conquered, this is way bigger than the invasion of Crimea, way bigger than the invasion of Georgia. This could prove just a massive extension of Russian power. I think Peter Zeihan is also correct to point out it could be a massive extension of Russian headaches. It does bring Russia conflict on a whole load of its different borders, and maybe that will play into some of the things that we've been looking at in terms of an alliance between Russia and Germany. But even so, just a very direct fulfillment of that forecast that we just heard from Mr. Flurry. So, massive proof of some of these end time warnings that we've been sounding for years. That particular, I played that particular quote from that particular Key of David because it was so direct and explained some of that in so much detail. That was from 2016. There were even older ones that made similar points going, I think there's one I saw from 2014. Even earlier ones. This is something that Mr. Flurry has been saying for a long time because of those Bible prophecies. So this is just a massive confirmation that we are in end times, that the Bible tells us what is going to happen in these end times, that you can study the Bible and understand. You can understand what's going to happen in the years ahead. You can understand Russia's behavior. Most importantly, you can understand the plan that God is working out behind these activities, behind these news events. So I'd really encourage you to study into that. We'd be very happy to send you that book, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. We've got another one that we've got up on the screen as well, Russia and China in Prophecy. Both of those really explaining this region. You can get those at thetrumpet.com. We're very happy to send you those booklets anywhere in the world. You can also give us a call, 1-866-930-3024. We have that free phone number if you're in the United States. If you're not in the United States, still though, you can go to our website. We do have offices around the world. You can look up phone numbers if you can't order them online. And it's all free. We're very happy to make this material available so you can understand God's plan that's going out here, because ultimately that's where the hope is behind all of these events. Well, I do have still like 3 pages of notes just talking about some UK stories. Let's see how much I can get to some of these in just a couple of minutes. We saw this week here in the UK, Twitter shutting down a news account it didn't like. It's just interesting to see how easy it is now to fall foul of the Twitter censors. This particular news account was Politics for All. They didn't even say anything negative about the vaccine or anything like that. All it did was basically expose the UK government. It was probably the news outlet that did the most to publicize these Downing Street parties where they were breaking their own rules. And it was reaching a new audience, a younger audience, having a massive following. I think I saw a billion impressions on some of their tweets about these government parties. And Twitter just shut it down. And it looks... it looks very iffy. The reasonings that they gave for shutting it down are incredibly tenuous. They basically did something that every other news organization does. They retweeted themselves and they found that excuse to shut this whole news site down. So we see some of this important news going on around the world. And if you get a popular news site that's mainstream, but maybe not quite towing the left's agenda. And it's incredible how quick and easy it is to be shut down. Another news story that I'll mention quickly is the jury just found in the UK that it's fine for you to topple statues that you don't like as long as you're woke. The people that knocked down Edward Colson's statue, we talked about this last year, they were put on trial for criminal damage. They got found innocent. The reasoning was incredibly convoluted, but... you've got this sense now where you can get away with breaking the law if it's in a leftist cause. That's something that we talk about in our book, America Under Attack. If you want to know more about some of those trends, I'd encourage you to go and order that on our website as well. We've got that that same website, thetrumpet.com. Well, that is about all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining us here and for joining us all week. You can send us any comments at td@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll be back on Monday here at 101.3 in the Edmond, Oklahoma area, kpcg.fm, channel 3 on CRN Digital Talk Radio, and live on video at thetrumpet.com.